Live from our nation's capital, it's the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop from Washington. I'm your host, Mark Levine, and all across the nation, fast food workers are going on strike. You want to go to McDonald's today? Well, you might have to cross a picket line because all over the nation, fast food workers are striking and struggling to get their minimum wage raised. The minimum wage nationally is currently $7.25 an hour, making sure that people who earn only the minimum wage definitely live in poverty. Fast food workers are striking for $15 an hour, but is that too much? Will that hurt jobs? Or is this a very strong political issue? To help answer these questions, I've invited Laura Huizar. She's the staff attorney at the National Employment Law Project. Laura, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hi, Mark. Thanks so much for inviting me to join you.
Sure. So first of all, tell me what's going on today.
Sure. Today's a big day for the Fight for 15 movement. We're seeing workers in about 270 cities today go out and strike or organize protests or rallies to basically call for an increase in the minimum wage to $15 an hour, as well as union rights. So it's a big day. Workers are showing they have a lot of power, and that the movement for 15 is growing.
Now, most fast food workers are not unionized, right?
That's correct. Most of the workforce is not unionized.
That's true. Is there even a fast food workers union?
I'm sorry?
Is there even a fast food workers union? I know there's a Service Employees International Union. Is that their union, or is there a fast food union?
I think there are multiple unions working with fast food workers, but I wouldn't, you know, want to give you a specific name or exclude people. But people are working to build union power there.
Is it difficult to organize if you're in the fast food industry?
I think in almost any industry, any low-wage industry, it's difficult to organize. I think workers are facing declining wages, declining conditions, difficulty in finding work, and I think it's a hard prospect for a lot of workers. But we're seeing, you know, more and more communities, more and more fast food workers realize that they have power and that there are a lot of benefits to come from coming together.
So tell me what it's like to live at $7.25 an hour working at a fast food restaurant. Why is that too low?
Well, $7.25 an hour is about $15,000 a year for someone who works full-time. And if you look at the cost of living in pretty much every part of the country, $15,000 a year is just not enough for someone to make ends meet, much less support a family or children. And so workers are realizing that they just cannot make it on the current minimum wage and are pushing for something that's more realistic at $15 an hour.
So you know the arguments conservatives make all the time, and I've argued personally to raise the minimum wage in many contexts. And the first thing they say is, well, there are not that many full-time workers that are working the minimum wage. This is mostly for kids having summer jobs. These aren't for people trying to take care of a family. What are the statistics on those earning the minimum wage in the fast food industry, for example, that are trying to take care of a family?
Right. Well, those numbers are just not accurate in our opinion. We know that about 42% of workers in the U.S. are making less than $15 an hour. So that includes fast food workers, retail workers, home care workers, and a lot of others who are struggling to make ends meet. We also know that, you know, many of them are older workers. I think a large percentage of them are 35 years or older. And so they're not, for the most part, teenagers taking on a part-time job, you know, while they're still in school. We also know that they're disproportionately, you know, women and people of color who are making these low wages. And so this is an issue that affects a lot of working families and a lot of people of color and women. So it's a huge issue for this country.
Now, the minimum wage, unlike other parts of the U.S. government, is an index to rise with inflation. Social Security benefits are, a lot of other benefits are. This one isn't. What is $7 or $15 an hour? How does that compare with other minimum wages in the past if you take into account the rate of inflation?
Right. So, right, $7.25 today is not indexed. It's basically at the lowest point it's been in decades. I think, you know, $15 is closer to what the peak was. I think a little above what the peak value of the minimum wage was around 1968. So it would be a more realistic level for workers to make ends meet. That's what we know.
So what are you hoping to accomplish by the strike? Is this mostly awareness? Is this something where people will remain not working until wages go up? How does this help?
I think this strike and the fast food workers movement is, or what they're organizing today is, you know, an opportunity for them to come together to show that they are powerful, powerful as workers in their own cities and their own workplaces, but also powerful as voters. And the one significant aspect of today's rallies and protests is that it's happening 1 year before the election in 2016. So they're making a statement. They're saying, we're low-wage workers. You know, we're trapped in a cycle of declining wages and rising inequality, and we have power to do something about it.
So employers are pushing back, of course. They're saying, well, if you want us to pay what you might call a living wage, $15 an hour, we're just going to go to touch screens. We're going to basically fire a bunch of people. I wonder if you have a response to that.
That is a common response we hear, but what the evidence tells us so far is that places that have raised the minimum wage are not seeing reductions in job growth. We're seeing that workers in low-wage industries are very often working with clients or local communities, and their jobs are not jobs that can be outsourced or simply, you know, given to some sort of technology. So we're seeing job growth in places like Seattle or San Francisco that have increased the minimum wage. And raising wages is proving to be an opportunity to help workers, but also help businesses.
One of the things that I've found outside of the fast food industry, because I don't know that it's happened too much there, but with other minimum wage jobs, it's interesting. Costco, for example, has consciously made sure that it pays its workers a living wage. People like me, good liberals, I go to Costco, I shop there, I recognize that. I wouldn't enter a Walmart because I know that they don't pay their workers well. But then Walmart just recently has actually done this whole ad campaign about how they're raising workers' wages. Could it be that the businesses that don't pay their workers enough actually lose business?
Well, I think that's one argument that workers are making as part of the fast food movement, and we are seeing more and more companies like Walmart increase their wages to both show consumers that they do care about their workers, but also because it's a smart business decision for them. I think Walmart has said, you know, that they're raising wages, one, you know, to help workers make ends meet, but also because it helps reduce turnover, it helps customer service, and at the end of the day, it's good for the company's bottom line.
Makes sense to me. I want to take a quick break and give our listeners a chance to call in if they want to. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back right after this.
He's a Harvard economist and a Yale lawyer. He does not keep up with the Kardashians. He's Mark Levine. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275. And now, the voice of reason in an unreasonable world, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. My guest is Laura Huizar. She's the staff attorney at the National Employment Law Project, and she is helping the workers all across the nation, actually in 270 cities, start a protest and a strike for a $15 an hour wage. Laura, I'm going to get to some of my calls, if I could. Let's go to Matt in New York on line two. Hey, Matt, how are you?
Matt, you there? Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Hey, Matt.
Hello.
What are your thoughts on $15 an hour?
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Hello?
I don't think Matt can hear me. That's not good. All right.
Can you hear me?
See if we can correct that with Matt.
It should be good now.
It should be clear now. Can you hear me now, Matt?
I can hear you. Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, good. Terrific. So what are your thoughts on the fast food protests?
Well, my thoughts are, you know, in a country where democracy is supposed to be for the people, by the people, I think the fact that these workers aren't able to unionize, number one, does a big statement towards the influence of corporations and over their workers. Corporations are no longer accountable to their workers and the people within the organization. They're only accountable to, their shareholders. So, I think there are a lot of things that need to be done, but these are small steps to kind of rebalancing that power.
Laura, tell me, if you would, a little bit about how difficult it is to unionize and why. Well, hang on, Matt. Let me let Laura respond and you can talk. Go ahead, Laura.
It is very hard for some workers to unionize, but I think what the fast food movement, what the movement is telling us is that by coming together and having a unified voice, the opportunity to move working conditions in the workplace and to move what workers are entitled to under the law can, in fact, change over time.
Matt, you had more to say. Go ahead. Matt, did you have some more to say?
Oh, no, I was just going to say, in terms of also, putting it to $15 an hour, I'm a little torn on that. I have pros and cons to that in terms of its blanket effect over the whole country. But I think that in terms of kind of addressing income inequality, studies show that when there's more money injected into the economy by, low to middle income earners, small businesses are able to be created, and it has a ripple effect on the entire economy. So,
okay, let me ask Laura that question. So, Laura, why 15? I mean, 15 is a number. Like any number, it's arbitrary. It could be 20. Hillary Clinton has called for 12, which is certainly much better than workers have now, but it's not quite 15. Where do we get the number 15?
Right, and that's a number that's come out of the Fight for 15 movement. I think that they understand $15 to be the number at which a worker or a family can really have a realistic chance of making ends meet. And what we see is that across the country, annually $30,000 a year, which is what a worker would be making at 15, is just barely enough to support a family, even in a lot of low-cost areas. So it's gotten a lot of support, certainly in places like New York and California, but we're starting to see the number resonate with a lot more workers in a lot more places.
Should the number be different? I mean, Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, these are obviously cities that are extremely expensive. Cost of living is extremely expensive. If you go to rural Arkansas, presumably, the cost of living is much cheaper. Should there be a differing wage depending on where you are?
I think that the movement is growing towards a unified 15 demand, and we are seeing federal lawmakers pay attention to that. And there's, in addition to the $12 bill, we now have a $15 bill sponsored by Senator Bernie Sanders, and about 200 economists have signed on in support of that bill at the federal level. So
I will say this. I know when you're negotiating, it's important to start. You can start with 15, perhaps nationwide, and then if it had to go down to even 12 in Arkansas or something, that would still be a tremendous increase for the people there. Thank you for your call, Matt. Let me go to Manny in California on line 3. Hey, Manny, how are you? Manny on line 3 in California.
He's there.
Yes, Mark. Yes, I am.
Yes. What are your thoughts on this?
I think it will help the economy more than anything. And us as Democrats, this is one thing we should run on. I mean, it's unbelievable that we speak up, but when it comes to defending and voting for this, we back down.
Well, what are the effects on the economy, Laura? It's not just on the workers themselves. What are the overall effects for the nation's economy?
I'm sorry, you were cut off a little bit. You were saying, what are
the effects for the nation's economy, not just for the individual workers?
Mm-hmm. And I think, the evidence would tell us that putting more money in the hands of low-wage workers is going to pump more money back into the economy, into small businesses. We're seeing, I think about 60% of small businesses at this point support increasing the minimum wage to $12, and we think that there are a lot of benefits to be had, not just for workers, but for the economy as a whole.
Let me address the other issue Manny raises, which is the political issue. He said Democrats are always backing down. Is there a reason to think that this is a political issue that would help the Democrats politically?
We are seeing the Democratic presidential candidates, come to a consensus on supporting the fight for 15, and we're seeing, candidates speak out in terms of specific numbers that they're supporting. So we hope that the fight for 15 will continue to build, and it looks like lawmakers are paying attention. This is a powerful new voting bloc, and the potential for change is big.
Okay, we only got about a minute left, but let me go quickly to Jeff from Arizona on line two. Hey, Jeff, how are you?
Hello.
Hey, Jeff, real quick, we only got about a minute left here. Well, what's your point?
All right, well, it's arbitrary, the $15 an hour, and they're going to get reduced hours, and these are low-end workers. They have no skill. So to put a $15 an hour marker on it is to say that with no skill, no high school diploma, whatever they, most of these people are young people, 18, 19, 20, my kids' age that are don't have any skill. How can you give them $15 an hour?
Jeff, I just addressed that specific question with Laura. 42% of the people that are earning fast food are the primary wage earners for their families. And a good number are not low. I mean, there are some, obviously, young people. That may be a quarter of it. There are a lot of people who make their primary wage is the minimum wage.
If I can just add to that, I think that 42% of workers in the country are making under 15 an hour, and a lot of them are home care workers, nursing home workers, people who take care of our families or help us in other ways. And so these are important industries, and the fight for 15 is growing as a result of more people seeing that they just can't make ends meet in most of these jobs.
I realize, Jeff, these are low-skill labor workers, but, if they can earn the minimum wage, then those with more skills can earn even more, and we can start dealing with some of the income inequality in this country. You disagree?
Do I disagree? I'm sorry.
No, did we lose Jeff? Jeff may have left because we only had about a minute. So let me just conclude by saying, how can people help the cause, Laura?
I'm sorry, what was that? I'm sorry,
I just want to know how people can help the cause.
Well, I think supporting workers today will be huge. It's a great moment in which we're getting a glimpse of how much power workers have when they come together. And I think participating in local and statewide fights will make a big difference, and also making federal legislators pay attention to what's going on in the worker movement.
Well, Laura Wiesauer, thank you so much for coming here on the Inside Scoop. I do appreciate it. When we come back, I want to talk about what's going on in Missouri and why it took the prospective resignation of the football team to finally get them to take action against racism there. This is Mark Levine, toll-free number 888-48-MARK. Be right back after this.
He's a Bible-quoting, Constitution-loving, flag-waving, red-blooded, liberal American. He's Mark Levine. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. Back to the Aggressive Progressive, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. Well, it took the football team threatening to go on strike to finally get Tom Wolf, the dean of the University of Missouri, to resign. A lot of other things didn't work. The students went on strike. The graduate students protested. One student even tried a hunger strike. Nothing seemed to get the dean of the University of Missouri to do anything about a number of racist incidents on campus, including the most famous, the most disgusting, there's no really easy way to say this, a drawing of a swastika in a human excrement, I guess is the nicest way I can say this. That wasn't the only thing, though. There was a long series of racist incidents at the University of Missouri. And again, there were protests. There were student groups. There were even a hunger strike. It's fascinating to me, the power, really, of these athletes. Because they know the only thing that really gets universities to do anything is money. And college sports has always been a huge moneymaker for colleges. In fact, all too often, the football coach is paid more than the university dean. So it's fascinating to me that no one listens to a hunger strike. They don't care if a student might starve to death, but the moment that the football team threatens to go on strike, and this is a football team with, I think, a 4-5 record. It wasn't the nation's leading football team. But apparently they'd be fined $1 million by the football authorities, and more importantly, they'd lose the revenue from the game. That caused University of Missouri president to resign. And I'm curious to know if this is going to be something that athletes try in the future. I think they're newly discovering their power. If you want to call in, it's 888-48-MARK, 888-48-6275. Let's go to Reggie and George on line one.
How you doing, Mark and Mark? I mean, how you doing, Mark?
I'm doing good. Talk to me, Reggie.
Okay. Well, see, this guy, had he known what was happening around the school and at his job, I think he should have done something about it and stepped up to the plate. And if he didn't, he should have resigned a long, long time ago. If he knew that these things was happening under his watch, he didn't do anything to stop it. He did nothing to stop it. But you have people like, well, such as Rush Limbaugh saying that the only reason why this guy stepped down and resigned from his position or post is because he committed the ultimate crime of being a white male in this country.
Oh, that's silly. It's not that he's a white male. It's that he's doing nothing about incident after incident of racism on his campus. And
right.
He wasn't listening to his own students. He wasn't listening to his own faculty members. They were all protesting incident after incident at the university. And he really turned a deaf ear to all of this until the football team decided to get involved. Now he suddenly cared.
Right. And, you know, why is it that whenever we stand up for our rights and our beliefs and what we represent, well, what this country represents and stands for or is supposed to represent and stand for, which is the American melting pot, we get attacked by the right with things such as this. Like they're getting attacked from the right, such as things like this, you know? That they're rabble-rousers, that they're causing trouble, that they're troublemakers and whatnot, so on and so forth, and et cetera, you know?
It's just fascinating to me that, again, a hunger strike and a protest by graduate students that didn't do anything, but the football team did. And I'm curious, Reggie, do you think that football teams now in college universities will be doing the same thing nationwide when they find incidents of racism or other things that they want to protest?
Hopefully. Now, what would have happened by the exact same token, what would have happened had a black, shall we say, president of that university, the exact same university, same scenario, did this to a bunch of, you know, turned a blind eye on a bunch of, you know, white students that were being, well, discriminated against, even though that's virtually impossible, you know, reverse racism and all that. What would have happened to him, Mark?
It's hard for me to even imagine such a situation, honestly, Reggie. I can't picture it, but I'm sure he'd be out the door.
Exactly. He would have been out the door a long, long time ago, right?
I suspect so. Hey, thanks for calling in, Reggie. I appreciate it. Folks, if you want to join in on this topic, please feel free to call in. The toll-free number is 888-48-MARK, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back right after this.
He's a Bible-quoting, Constitution-loving, flag-waving, red-blooded, liberal American. He's Mark Levine. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275. Back to the Aggressive Progressive, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. The president of the University of Missouri, Tim Wolf, wasn't going to do much in response to campus incidents of racism. It didn't matter when a swastika was in human excrement on a new white wall. It didn't matter when students were harassed. It didn't matter when the students and the faculty went on protest. It didn't even matter when suggested a hunger strike. Graduate student Jonathan Butler began a hunger strike November 2nd and vowed not to eat until Wolf was gone. It was only when the college football team threatened to go on strike that suddenly the president felt the heat. We all know that college sports don't make money for the athletes, but they do make money for the university. And it's one thing to have students threaten to kill themselves through hunger strikes. That doesn't faze a president. But no football game, he had to go. What does this say about culture is, what our priorities are, and whether or not this is going to be a protest of choice in the future? Toll-free number, 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. David in Massachusetts on line one. Welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hey.
Hey. What are your thoughts?
How you doing?
I'm good.
How are you? Is this Mark?
Yes, it is.
Oh, hi. How you doing? Great. But, well, you know, two things. I got a point and a question. You know, we all saw the civil rights movement in the 60s, especially, 50s and 60s, and we saw the hoses and the dogs and the lynching and all that. And there's people around still with us that went through that. And to me, it was, they should be outraged by these people on these campuses. I mean, you want to see what real racism was and real suffering was. Go back to what they went through and the work that they had to do to make the changes so that these kids now could literally, you know, live in a pretty much racist, not totally, but a far less racist country than they certainly brought up in.
You know, what's interesting is that they had the same point. One of the ways that racism was fought in the 1950s, of course, was through the famous Montgomery bus boycott. It wasn't that people were trying to lose values. There was some of that, of course. But a lot of white people didn't budge, particularly in Alabama. Black people demanded the right to eat at lunch counters and so forth because of their human dignity. But they went on strike and they hurt the bus industry. And suddenly people noticed. Suddenly people cared. Uh-huh. The Montgomery bus boycott lasted for more than a year until it finally achieved something. And I think the football players are learning the same technique. You got to hit them in the pocketbook because appealing to racial
question
work.
That leads to my question. And regardless of what the issue is, do we really want this sort of movement for change being directed or being propagated by a bunch of 20-year-old football players? I mean, if that's the kind of thing that's going to get colleges to erupt in these sort of, you know, protest-type things, is that the kind of thing we really want? I mean, back in, like you were talking about in the 50s, the people started this movement. These were adults. These people saw a real problem that needs to be addressed. I think this is a phony problem. I really do. I don't know what they expected the university president to be able to do about somebody driving by a pickup truck and yelling something racist or someone throwing cotton balls on the floor. What's he supposed to actually do about that?
Well, I think one of the things he can do is make clear that those kinds of incidents have no place at the university.
Well, that, you know,
immediately, they could promise an investigation. They could install cameras. They could, you know, go and interview people. There are ways to basically take these things seriously, and it seems to me showed that he really didn't care, that it wasn't very much. And, you know, do I want football players to lead the way? No, not really. I don't know that they're the best ones to lead the way, but everyone else tried everything else. We talked about the students going on strike, the graduate students going on strike, the faculty going on strike. One kid even did a hunger strike, and that didn't move the administration. I find it ironic
that the football players had the maximum impact. I don't think it's the way it should be, but given that money seems to be the only thing that anyone listens to, I get it. I don't like it, but I get it.
What I don't understand is that people that you really are involved in this movement can't tell you exactly why. They're not specifically telling you anything that's egregious. I mean, the campus didn't allow the KKK to march on campus. They didn't, you know, these kids are being coddled for most of their lives, for the most part, and yet they don't realize how good they have it. And turning it upside down, I think it's a lot of external forces being brought into the situation to really agitate, and I do believe that happened in Ferguson, and it's no coincidence it happens right down the street in Mizzou.
Well, but what happened in Ferguson, you got to remember, somebody died. And they didn't have any body cameras, and it's not clear what happened. And, this is a way for people to say, you know, we matter. And we can't live in a state of fear because of racist incidents. And, I think a different president could have come out, deplored the incident, said he's going to do investigation. I mean, it wasn't just that. There were a number of incidents that occurred time after time after time, and this president wasn't responding.
They arrested the kids with the cotton balls, and they expelled the kids. One of the kids got expelled, I think it was there was another incident of something. It's just so, look at, you know, these kids have no backbone, they have no spine, but they can get together and have a mob, and all of a sudden they got power, like you were saying. Individuals should be able to handle a situation where someone helps them, or somebody does, even if it's not racist or sexist or homophobic. It's just one person on one person. It's not systemic. That is the most idiotic thing I've heard about this whole thing. It's some
no,
sort
but
of
it wasn't just the swastika. There were a number of people have been shouting racial epithets. They know who these people are. These are incidents. Some of them are from students. Maybe you should be expelled if you're going to, you know, shout racial slurs at kids. I mean, this is a university, and they can have a certain decorum out there.
The cure to this problem is what people would really appreciate, because you're looking at, albeit you don't like racial slurs, you don't like people driving around Confederate flags and whatnot, but you know what? You have to allow things that you don't like. Otherwise, you're going to make it, what, illegal? And then you squash speech, and where does it go from there? I know I hate, you know, everybody hates racism. Everybody hates, you know, all these things, the isms that go down the list. But you know what? We live in a free country. And if you can't deal with it individually, you know, you really can't always just get your mob together. And there's a lot of people affected by this sort of thing. And, you know, I don't think the president needed to resign. I don't think it was his fault necessarily.
You don't think he should have done something about when the swastika appeared, he shouldn't have come out and said
what?
This has no place at the university say he's going to... I mean, that was vandalism. That wasn't just speech, right? I mean, they're actually putting human excrement on a plain white wall at the university. This is a crime, and it's, of course, more than a crime. It's a hate crime because it's designed specifically to cause fear and therefore, the president, I think, should have taken a very strong stand, said that this has no place in the university, that they're going to find out who did this, they're going to prosecute, and if it's a student, they're going to expel the student. I think any university that would do this, and the fact that Tim Wolf didn't, I think, says that he wasn't a good president.
Sorry to say that, but what can a guy do, really? What's he supposed to do?
Well, I told you what he could do.
Of course you're going to ban swastikas on campus, of course. That's kind of, you know, who wouldn't? And is that necessarily, that would be more of an anti-Semitic statement than a racist anything, I think.
Whether it's anti-Semitic or racist, whatever it is, you expect a president to make a strong stand after that. And the fact that he didn't, I think, says that he had to resign. But here's what I find so interesting, is that he didn't care about a massive student protest. He didn't care about a massive faculty protest. He didn't care about a massive graduate student protest. He didn't care about a kid that was going on a hunger strike. He only cared when the football team said they wouldn't play. That tells me something about what his priorities were, right?
I agree with that, yeah. It did take the bottom line, and it does. Money is probably behind all of this, but you're right. But I fear that if this sort of thing catches on, and, of course, the most powerful group of people we know on campus now are the football teams or the basketball teams. And God knows what kind of leverage they're going to feel they can have and what sort of things they can all of a sudden control at a university via their protesting or their lack of playing the games. And that's why I said, do you really want a bunch of, you know, basically children dictating things around everybody? You know, I agree with
David, I don't think they were the most thoughtful. I think everyone that protested was thoughtful. I just think they were the most powerful because they had their hands around the moneymaker for the college. It wasn't that they were thoughtful. They just had the power. But I appreciate your call, and I appreciate your exchange. Let me go to Maria in Santa Fe on line two. I think she has a different view. Go ahead, Maria.
I think that when people are using their power for good, then that's the absolute best that they can do with it. And I don't think you have to be 50 to realize when you're being treated horribly.
And, I mean, so how do you respond to David's suggestion that there was really nothing the president could do about this? Maria, well, how would you respond to that? I can't hear Maria. So, if we can get Maria, oh, we lost Maria, she hung up. Okay, well, the question is how could the president have responded? And I've told you how I think he could have responded. All he had to say was, you know, he would have had like a speech. He would get out there. They would wipe it clean right away. He would say that this has no place at our university. He's going to track down the people who did this. He's going to punish them. He's going to seek criminal charges, and he's going to expel them if they do this. Because people need to understand why hate incidents are so powerful. I think some people have trouble understanding why that is. If somebody burns a cross, for example, you could say, well, that's just speech. That's just like the Klan. They're just saying they're racist. Okay. But what it does do is that it causes students to live in fear. It causes them to feel like that they're not welcome there. And it's not just an attack on one student. It's an attack on all of them. I think we have Maria back. Maria, we lost you for a moment there, but welcome back to the show.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Mike, the basketball players stood up for what was right. I think that the president should have stood up for what was right. And obviously he has a lot more power than most people would think because he could have done an investigation. He could have gone and found out who was responsible for this. You know, this kind of crime is something where it's threatening.
It is threatening because people don't feel safe. I'm curious to know what you think the president should have done, if there's something that you have in mind.
Well, I just would reiterate what you said. An investigation should have been done. He should have gone and talked to the students and said, this isn't right, and we're going to get to the bottom of it. And I'm on your side. I want you to know that this is something that I do not tolerate.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I don't think he would have taken that much. I don't think it was a huge deal. I think, frankly, students expect the president of their university to be on their side when they're attacked. You know, when there's a much more serious attack, when there's a gun attack or something, you see the presidents of universities come out. They're proactive. They're shutting down the campus. They're coming out and talking about security. Okay, that's a more serious matter. People are dying. But even if it's just an attack on students, even if it's just someone claiming the university is no good, you expect presidents to come out and defend their university. In this case, it was an attack on students. It was an attack on students because of their race, religion, whatever it was. And it wasn't just the swastika. This is a pervasive incident. If it were that alone, that may have been the last straw. If it were that alone, there wouldn't have been such a reaction. But they've got real problems in Missouri, and people are on edge, and simply letting people know that you're on their side. That's all the president had to say. I'm on your side. I'm as outraged as you are. We're going to do something about it. Real quick, Maria, last word.
All the president had to say.
I think she's gone. Folks, I really enjoyed the show today. We'll be back, of course, tomorrow for more of the Inside Scoop. Tonight is the fourth Republican debate. It's on an obscure channel, the Fox Business News channel. I don't know if anyone will watch it, but I will watch it, and I will give you the Inside Scoop tomorrow. So if you want to talk about the debate, please tune in. It may be the end of Jeb Bush, for all we know. It should be a very interesting debate. This is Mark Levine. You can follow me on Twitter at Mark Levine Talk.